You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network.
On a, what day of the week is it? It is a it's a Wednesday. Welcome on a Wednesday. Mike McNamara with you. A Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here in your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Hopefully all the gremlins have been worked out of the system. I'll tell you what happened yesterday. And you know what? This is always the case. Okay, so you have a mixer, right? Right. And it's got about a million switches on it, eh? Yeah, that's Canadian for yes. So, I was having problems with one of the channels bleeding over. You may have heard it. In the background, very faintly, sometimes you could hear when I would have somebody on Skype, you would hear some stuff in the background there. Well, anyway, so I was trying to fix that. Yeah. Man, I won't bore you with the details, but, well, the details are important, so I have to bore you with them. So, there's a left and right channel, right? Okay. So, the left channel is the mono channel. So, if you're going to route audio, mono audio, you can use one input, and you route it in to the left input on the board. Okay. Now, next to that is a button, right? And that button sends the output through what's called a live wire. It's kind of looks like kind of an octagon shaped thing and has a USB opening at the other end. But it's not really an octagon. It's kind of a maybe a hexagon with a flat bottom. That thing? Yeah. So anyway, that's what takes the audio from the mixer to the computer. Every tracking so far? Good. Okay. So, as I attempted to kind of jury-rig, trick-fuck the Skype audio into the board, unbeknownst to me, I hit the button. Right? Now, that routes audio, the button that routes audio to the live wire. Okay? Now, I don't know exactly what you call that wire, but that wire. So what then happened was it sent different audio to the live wire. Yeah, the audio that I send through phones that is turned way down so it doesn't blow the phone up, that's what got sent into the output. And for the life of me, I could not figure out what the fuck I did. And you know what? And this is always the case. I mean, you go back to doing radio years ago, over-the-air radio. And when you have something like this happen, it's always some shit like that. It is always, when you finally find it, it's like you flip a switch, you press a button, and the whole thing goes back to normal. And you're just so pissed because you can't find it. So I had to interview General Furness yesterday, and I'm running around. I can't do it. Thank God, you know, I have an expeditionary capability, so I just went expeditionary, and you'll hear him today. 2nd Marine Division just conducted, you know, the largest, I think, exercise that's happened in my lifetime out in the desert. They got the division out there and did a force-on-force exercise. So you can hear from General Furness. First of all, why do that? What were you trying to learn? And second of all, what happened? And, you know, where are you in the process? Have you got the lessons learned back? Are you in the process of it? Blah, 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 blah. So anyway, we're going to find that stuff out. So we'll talk to him today. But very happy that electronically I am whole again, and that makes me happy. So yeah, you've got that going for you. Anyway, good morning to you on this Wednesday morning. I forgot. Give you an update on Colleen School. Yeah, Estancia High School here in Southern California. Somebody posed with a BB gun on social media and said, yeah, don't go to school tomorrow. On at 11:30, some shit's going to get straight or something like that. So anyway. But what it dredges up for me is my trip to the school board, and it just pisses me off. So now I've got to go through that exercise in futility again. And again, if you're an elected official, or you know what, you're married to one, or you know one, you don't have the right to not protect my kid. You don't have that right. You have to protect my kid. I can't drop my kid off at school and then go pick my kid up at the morgue. That's bullshit. And hope's not a COA. Hope's not a course of action. You know, the odds are that it's not going to happen to us. Right. So what happens if it's not a BB gun? What happens if it's not posted on social media and the dude just shows up? We're going to wait the 6 minutes till hopefully the cops can get there, and then we get what we get? I mean, come on. That's so fucking ridiculous. It's a joke. So anyway, one community resource officer for 38 schools. Oh, my God. I have to stop. I have to put an end to that. So that's part of my agenda. Let me tell you what's part of your agenda today. We're going to take a look at, if you haven't noticed, between Lebanon, Iraq, and Iran, right? The Empire of Iran is not doing so well. Okay? The Persian Empire, not so much these days. Supposedly over 200 people killed in the last week, and the number is probably three times that you just, it hasn't got out yet, in both Iraq and Iran. So what we're going to do today is we're going to go through and we're going to check out audio reports and video reports, although you can't see the video. You'll hear the reporting from that's been done in the last few days from all three of those places. Pretty interesting stuff. Pretty interesting stuff. So we'll do that today. You also, the family kind of an interesting little flare that hit my phone yesterday. Here's, I'm going to read you a little bit of this. Our father helped found the future Navy SEALs. His vision didn't include Edward Gallagher. Subheadline, the founder of Hell Week and elite teams that became Navy SEALs knew valor alone was worthless. A SEAL must embody duty and honor too. By Draper Kaufman and Kelsey Kaufman. Right? So it's an opinion piece now. Right? There's a picture of Draper Kaufman Sr. at Fort Pierce, Florida in November of 1941. The month before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, I have to tell you something. One of the things I find so interesting and cool is in this picture, right? So here's a guy who's, I don't know what rank he is because I can't see it on his uniform. He's wearing his khaki trousers and his khaki long sleeve shirt. It looks like he's got a black belt on, right? The black belt is like clearly way off size, right? And what we would know as your uniform gig line isn't even close. Now, what is a gig line on your uniform? Well, if you start from your crotch and there's a line that comes up where your trousers, where the fabric overlaps, that line that goes vertical, that line should align perfectly with your shirt and the edge of your belt buckle. That's the way we do it now. World War II, man, they just threw their shit on. Yeah, they were going to work. And I think it's hilarious. Same thing like with, I say this a lot, but with World War II, right? You can't find two Marines in the picture that have the same uniform on. Shit, they have like, they wear everything. Right? They have khaki shirts on, they have piss cutters on, and they're like, they're ashore on Iwo Jima. Bust out my piss cutter and throw it on. Now, your piss cutter, for those of you who don't know, I'm not even sure what the origin of the word is, but I should look that up. Now I'm interested. It's that narrow hat that goes on your head. How do I describe it? Let's see. Legion guys wear it, right? Marine Corps League guys wear red ones. But American Legion wear blue guy, you know, with that narrow hat that comes. The barracks cover has a brim. Right? It's the one you know. It has a brim, and it's got the big emblem in the center on top and whatnot. That's a barracks cover. The piss cutter is that made of only fabric, right? It's narrow and vertical and sits on your head. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, we bust those out anywhere. So anyway, I want to share with you that email because it's pretty interesting. So it's pretty interesting in the last week what you've seen is pushback to this narrative that in this fight over, you know, in my opinion, the soul of the United States Navy SEALs, you're seeing this pushback as Chief Gallagher goes on TV and he plays the victim card. I was a victim in all that, right? All these people, all ego, right? And nothing I did, you know, nothing I did certainly warranted this kind of reaction. So anyway, you're seeing people push back on that. So, good Wednesday morning to you. And then we'll cover the news a little bit, and then you'll hear from General Furness, him talking about, a ginormous exercise on 29 Palms. And you'll hear him talk about why. We say we want to talk about to fight a peer, but, and I'll just give you a little tease to the interview. So when we talk about the way that just about everybody except the old people in the Marine Corps have experienced life since about 2001. So that means you're almost ready to retire. Your entire enlistment or your entire term of service in the Marine Corps, you would have spent fighting insurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan. You would have dabbled in the march up, right, in large-scale conflict with a near peer. That really wasn't a near peer, okay? We evaluate him as a near peer because of his equipment, right? When we moved to contact, doesn't work out that way, right? So the near peer is not a near peer. He's not even close to a near peer because he can't operate the equipment. He can't operate against an enemy, and really that's what you got to be able to do. So anyway, so that would have been your entire career. So when we talk about fighting a peer that has the same kind of ability to collect electronic signatures, and if you can be collected on, if you can be identified, then you can be shot. And the munitions are absolutely lethal, and they have a lot of them. Right? And suppose that the airspace isn't like, for instance, we do not worry about being attacked from the sky. Now we have to worry about little drones and shit like that, but we don't have to worry about, somebody's MiGs rolling in on us. We don't worry about it. The skies are completely permissive. Electronically in Iraq and Afghanistan, completely permissive. We put up satellite dishes and we shoot microwave shots and we're all hooked into chat. We have operation centers that have, you know, 5 big screen TVs across the front, you know, 65-inch screens tracking, right, the combat operating picture, right, tracking the intel picture, tracking what Fires is doing, tracking what the intel guys are doing in terms of ISR, right, the latest ISR that we're focused on is up there, blah, 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 you know, and we don't move them. Well, what they just practiced was you can't have any of that. It's got to be mobile, and it's got to move on a regular basis. And when you transmit, you got to transmit short bursts, and you got to use all the masking tools that we have relative to comm people. And so a completely different mindset relative to the fight. And so you'll hear General Furness talk about that. Also, you know, just the logistics of we don't fight as divisions, you know. In Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, we fought as battalions. Right? It was, and so you're talking about companies moving. Well, now you're not. You're talking about regiments moving. How long does it take to put a regimental obstacle in? And so you'll hear him talk about stuff like that. So, but again, nobody has that experience. Nobody. The logisticians never have done something like this. And the cool part about exercises, and you'll hear us talk about this, is, you know, for aviators and people like logisticians, I mean, you know, whether they're doing it out in 29 Palms or they're doing it going to Iraq or Afghanistan, it's all the same for them to be able to do it and learn those lessons. So the only artificialities are kind of with the combat arms guys as they close with, you know, a fictitious enemy. But everybody else is getting real reps and reps they've never, ever had before. So kind of interesting, not kind of, I think always interesting listening to General Furness talk about that stuff. So anywho. What else is going on today? Let's see. That's it. I want to talk about quitting, too. We had a little episode in our house about quitting. And so I'm against quitting. And let me tell you why you should be against quitting. Your kids quitting, your grandkids quitting, right? Anybody you know quitting. Okay? Quitting doesn't solve anything. The only person normally that gets punished when they quit something is the person that quit. A job, a sport, whatever. So what are the elements of quitting? Something becomes so intolerable, I can't do it anymore. Okay, well, why did it get to that stage? Okay? And so know this, you allowing it to get to that stage is part of the problem. Do you think this is the last time you're ever going to face a situation like this, where you don't particularly see eye to eye somebody that you work with or for? I'll give you the answer to that. The answer to that is no. Okay, so you've got to learn the life skill of working, playing for, working with, being an employee of, somebody that you don't see eye to eye with on stuff. And that's going to happen in your life. And you're not going to be able to quit. So you've got to develop the skills, right, to make it work. So how do you make it work? if you're in this case an athlete. And your coach tells you that, well, you don't know how to play. I know, I've only played this sport for a year. Okay, so what's the next step? Is you confront the coach and you say, hey, I need somebody to tutor me. Because you won't let me play JV. And I think that's where I belong. But you say I'm too good. But then you tell me I don't know how to play, so I need you to help me bridge that gap because I don't know how to play. The system I played in last year is not what you do now, and I don't understand what you're doing. Can you help me? Okay. So in the absence of that, we're faking it. Like, okay, I don't really understand, and you're not giving me the help, and I'm unhappy, and this thing gets worse and worse and worse, and then we quit. It doesn't help anybody, right? Particularly the person that quits. There's an element of fortitude and perseverance that is essential to life. There's an element of problem solving that is essential to life, and there's an element of this is not going to be perfect, but I've got to learn how to make it work that's essential to life. And quitting doesn't solve any of that. So don't let your kids quit. Don't let your grandkids quit. And it's for their own good. Right? And what you'll hear is, but I was so unhappy. Like, I don't care. Look, first of all, your feelings, do you think you're going to be able to live your life based on your feelings? If you do, guess what? You're going to move back in with your mom and dad, and you're going to live in your old bedroom, and they're going to have to give you an allowance because life doesn't give a shit about your feelings. And I hate to break that to you because I know your teachers don't tell that to you, but in spite of what you've heard at school, nobody gives a shit about your feelings. Okay, so you got to, that is not the number one consideration here. Got it? Hashtag truth. Yeah. So I would offer that to you. We just went through that in my family. And learning occurred. It doesn't help anything, right? Now, let me tell you what they'll hear though, right? Oh, I think it took a lot of courage to, you know, stand up for themselves and quit. Because that coach XYZ, other player XYZ, look, I got all that. But that's the world in its imperfect state. That's the world you're going to go work in. That's the world that you're going to raise your kids in. That's the world you're going to be in. So you're just going to quit when the conditions aren't right? No, you've got to learn to overcome that and triumph over that. And other people do not dictate what you are. Quitting. No bueno, man. No bueno. So, with that said, the United States Marine Corps Band makes this Wednesday official. Good morning to you. This is dedicated to everybody who has somebody in their family that's quitting. Teach them the right thing. Okay? Teach them that that's not the solution. That is not the solution. Other people do not define your life and do not certainly stop you from doing the things that you want to do. And the skills that it takes to overcome that are really, really important skills in life. First of all, don't let it get that far. When you see that delta, that difference between what they want and what you want, go in, sit down with them and say, I need your help to solve this. Because I don't know X, Y, Z. And I need you to teach me. And then you just and stay in their shit. I don't understand. Right? Can you get me a tutor? Can you get me somebody that will work with me after practice on my shot? On this behavior that you want from me, because I don't get it. And I'll work hard and I'll do that. That's the fight through, right? That's the fight through. So this dedicated to everybody has that conversation, right? Do the right thing.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
It defines us. It defines warriors like Gunnery Sergeant John Canley, a leader who led from the front. With his Marines outnumbered, he pushed forward during the Battle of Way City, standing tall during firefights and throwing himself into harm's way to keep his fellow Marines safe.
The only thing I was doing was just responding. The Marines, the young Marines, it shows them that it's not do as I say, it's do as I do. And just being that close with them brings motivation to them.
During firefights, when we'd be all hugging Mother Earth, he'd be standing up directing us. And I think if you talk to every Alpha Company Marine, we're amazed that he was never shot.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore. So young folks, you ignore what I just said.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
If you don't love your Marines, then you really ought to get out. The only reason I stuck around that low paying outfit 40 years is for the absolute pleasure of serving alongside cocky, rambunctious, disciplined, selfless, unbelievably selfless young Marines. And the infantry got its name, young soldier. And I enjoyed being around them. And in the military, it's all about the team. And so if you don't know the team players beyond simply their rank and last name, you don't care about them deeply. I mean, just go up to Bethesda anytime you want to see the cost of war and see the ranks on the rooms that you're walking into. Lance Corporal here, Lance Corporal there, PFC here, Sergeant there, Lieutenant. If you don't care about these guys, don't expect them to care about what's important to you. They're putting their lives on the line.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah,
is PTSD. It's like having a cage in your brain. It's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once the bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose. So you want to keep them in the cage.
Once you're out of the core, you know, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful, and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor veteran, or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country. We care about what happens to everyone. Marine Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
Time to check the weather in Marineland here. Currently it is partly sunny in Quantico, Virginia, 43 degrees. It is sunny in 53, Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune. It is cloudy in 50 in 29 Palms. It is raining and 54 at Camp Pendleton. Camp Smith in Hawaii, dark, cloudy, and 70. Okinawa, raining, dark, and 66. In Lashkar Gah, in the southern part of Afghanistan, where evidently, in heavy fighting this week, the Afghan National Army, the ANA, took back the city of Marja. We'll see. We will see. So, yeah. It is clear, dark, and 55 degrees. And further to the southwest in the Al-Anbar province of Iraq, where Special Purpose Task Force works, Marines, it is clear, dark, and 55 early in the evening there. There's four weather advisories at the corporate headquarters of All Marine Radio. Yeah, how about that? We know three of them have to do with water. Well, there's a flood advisory, right, from 7:55 Pacific Standard Time on Wednesday, December 4th, until 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Wednesday, December 4th. So now until 2 o'clock. Flash flood watch from 6 a.m. This would be chiefly in the desert and in low-lying areas that have historic irrigation issues. That in effect from 6 a.m. this morning until 6 p.m. tonight. Small craft advisory and a marine weather statement. It is currently raining. And 57 degrees. The wind chill sits at 54. Going to rain tonight and tomorrow partly sunny and 67. On Friday partly sunny and 67. That is a look at your weather. Now, I don't really know if I want to take a break. You know what? I will. We'll take probably about a 90-second break, maybe 2 minutes. And we'll do that. We'll come back. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up.
This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Honestly, you know, my head feels like it's going to explode sometimes when I hear people talking about, the right thing to do is to quit. You know, the right thing is never to do is to quit. Don't do that. You teach. And then what you do is you embolden the quitter by telling them they acted with this moral courage and it was the right thing to do. Wrong. And you're teaching horrible lessons in life. When it doesn't go your way, quit. That is wrong as wrong can be. And you're also lining this thing up to coincide with what's the most important things is your feelings. And you are setting people up for failure in life. And that's the charade that the education system and all this messaging does to kids these days. Your feelings are so important. And then you get out in the world and nobody gives a shit about your feelings and you don't know what to do. Well, wait a minute. Where is somebody going to come and make this stuff stop? Nobody's coming. Nobody is coming. What do you mean? Nobody cares, man. What? Yeah, that was a joke. You got screwed, man. All that stuff they laid on you is bullshit. Right? And that may be what heaven's like, but that ain't what's happening here on earth, man. Nobody cares about you. You gotta go fight. You gotta go fight for every ounce of happiness. And then you gotta fight to protect all of that. What? Wait a minute. Where did this come from? How come nobody told me about it? They were too busy lying to you and give you a world that everybody thinks ought to exist, but it ain't the way it is. So anyway, all right. Yeah, no, it's crazy. All right, now I want to play a couple reports. The first one is from Iran, right? This is from the PBS NewsHour. What's going on in Iran? Okay, right, so each one of these reports was filed in the last like 4 or 5 days. Okay, so supposedly over 200 people have been killed in protests in Iran. So I want to play some of these things. So we're going to kind of do an update on Iran, which I wanted to do. So this is kind of the first step of it. I'm really trying to get Jeff Kennedy to become my Iranian expert, right? Because he's got an interest, because he served there. So with that said, headline of this report is behind the protests and brutal government crackdown in Iran. This is from the PBS NewsHour.
I'm Chef Marcus Samuelson, and as an immigrant born in Ethiopia and raised in Sweden.
You know what? Even though you go through this one time, once you reset the video, just, you know, I always wondered, how is YouTube ever going to make any money, right? Go figure, all right? Not only with selling your data and putting cookies and tracking all your shit, right? Yeah. California DMV made $50 million selling people's data last year.
Thousands, and what began as protests denouncing a hike in gasoline prices. But the uprising quickly turned political, with demands that top officials step down. The Iranian government responded with a five-day internet shutdown. So the user-generated video and accounts that raised awareness of past demonstrations were blacked out. We still know very little about what's happened. Yesterday, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said the protests were a U.S.-led plot to destroy the country.
It was a deep, extensive, and very dangerous conspiracy that cost the United States so much money and effort. They wanted to use an opportunity to carry out this move, which was an act of destruction, arson, murder, and vandalism under the pretext of a gasoline price increase.
The internet has been partially restored.
How crazy is that, right? It's just like the world's upside down in these countries.
And special correspondent Reza Seya joins us from Tehran, where he's been following the latest on the ground. Reza, it's good to see you. We know connectivity, being able to get any word out has been an issue. So fill us in. What is the latest on the ground?
I'm not giving you an update on the latest here in Iran. It's still a bit of a challenge because many Iranians are just now getting back online, just now getting their internet service back. The big news today here in Iran Thursday is that cell phone users are back online after being offline for the better part of 2 weeks. And it was a lack of internet connections for cell phone users that perhaps played the biggest part in this information blackout that we saw last week.
Can you imagine? They shut down. They shut down the internet in Iran for 2 weeks. I mean, and the cell phone system, right? Wow.
Information blackout that made it very difficult, nearly impossible, for many people to conclusively report on the magnitude and the scale and the intensity of the protests. That said, indications are that the protests have died down, and when you drive around Tehran today, nowhere near the security presence that we saw last week.
Reza, let's talk about why these protests are happening now. We mentioned that hike in gasoline prices. Do we have any idea why that decision was made in the first place?
It's impossible for us to say why authorities decided that this was the best time to raise gas prices at a time when many working-class Iranians are suffering so much and under so much pressure. But we can tell you that many Iranian officials and Iranian analysts have long said that raising gas prices is the right thing to do for Iran's economy. Remember, Iran's gas prices have long been heavily subsidized. They're some of the cheapest in the world, running about 50 cents per gallon. And officials here say that has led to high consumption and heavy smuggling, and something had to be done. But the fact that they decided to do it now is perhaps an indication of how much the economy is struggling, to a point where authorities had to take a desperate measure where there was a backlash. Sure. Then came the Trump administration, who pulled out of the nuclear deal, reimposed new sanctions. There was never any foreign investment that came in to Iran. Oil sales went down significantly. There was inflation, the devaluation of currency, unemployment, and that, many say, led to the government perhaps making that drastic measure, raising fuel prices. So again, many people argue that the U.S. sanctions had a huge role in what happened last week, but also many people argue that it's these U.S. sanctions that are hurting average Iranians and not impacting the government. And we can also tell you that when the protests happened, many groups, both inside and outside Iran, tried to take over the narrative. The hardliners here blamed the moderates on the rising fuel prices. The moderates blamed the hardliners. And in D.C., the Trump administration and the Iran hawks said the protests and the rising fuel prices were evidence that the U.S. sanctions were working. And on the other hand, the moderate observers of Iran said that the protests and the rising gas prices were an indication that the sanctions were only impacting average Iranians, and the fact that the government is still in power was proof that the sanctions were not working.
At one point, it was reported there were protests in more than 100 cities across the country. Tell us a little bit about the overall government response. Has the scale of these protests shaken them at all?
All indications are that the government reacted swiftly, they reacted brutally, and they reacted with deadly force, perhaps more deadly force than they've ever used. Over the past several days, we've heard a growing number of reports naming individuals who were allegedly killed by security forces during the protests. A lot of names are being posted online. Reports that we can't independently confirm. We can tell you that Amnesty International made headlines when they put out a report that more than 100 people were killed. This time, of course, they made the seemingly effective move of shutting down internet and, again, using deadly force very quickly.
Reza, these are easily among the largest demonstrations against the Islamic Republic since the revolution four decades ago. Not as large as the Green Revolution in 2009, though. But tell us what happens now.
What's interesting is that this week there were demonstrations in Tehran and other cities, sanctioned and approved by the government, where there were some people who were protesting against the rising fuel prices and a struggling economy. There were peaceful protests, and there was no violence. There was no crackdown. Also this week, there was a national newspaper with a headline criticizing Iranian state media of not hearing out the people's concerns. And you also have the supreme leader, the government leaders here continuing to say that the people's concerns must be met, that the something must improve with the economy, that the government must address the people's concerns. So you're hearing some rhetoric, but it still remains rhetoric. At this point, there's no indication that there's going to be a turnaround for the economy, that the economy is going to improve, and certainly no indication that the government is going to tolerate protests that evolve into something that the government sees as a threat.
All right, so that's the report on Iran. All right, so let's go to Iraq. This is a Reuters report.
Bloodshed spread across Iraq on Thursday to become one of the most violent days since the anti-government uprising began at the start of October. Iraqi security forces shot dead at least 45 protesters after demonstrators stormed and torched an Iranian consulate overnight. Most were killed in the southern city of Nasiriyah.
Okay, now, know this. Nasiriyah, right, that's Shiite land, okay? Notice that they didn't storm and burn the American consulate. They stormed and burned the Iranian consulate. What's going on?
That's where at least 29 people died when troops opened fire on demonstrators who blocked a bridge before dawn and later gathered outside a police station. The violence and the consulate burning could mark a turning point in the uprising against the Tehran-backed authorities after weeks of mass demonstrations and hundreds of deaths. Young, mostly Shiite protesters say politicians are corrupt and beholden to foreign powers, especially Iran. One protester told Reuters what he said happened at the consulate in Najaf.
Young men burned it when it was set on fire.
Kanan Najaf, again, south central Iran, which is Shiite land, and the Shiites identify with the Iranian form of Islam. Right, and the Shiites are the ones that have allowed the Iranians to essentially take over and have incredible sway inside of Iran, inside of Iraq.
All the riot police in Najaf and the security forces started firing on us, as if we were burning Iraq as a whole. The riot police fired tear gas canisters intensively, and the security forces showered us heavily with live bullets.
Several others were killed in the capital, Baghdad, where security forces opened fire with live ammunition and rubber bullets against protesters near a bridge over the Tigris River. The protesters had blamed the government for a failure to recover from years of conflict. The protests are the most complex challenge facing the Shiite-dominated ruling class that has controlled state institutions and patronage networks since the 2003 U.S.-led invasion that toppled longtime Sunni ruler Saddam Hussein.
Cybersecurity.
So there's a report from Iran. So from Iraq. So, I mean, again, fascinating that, you know, that what's been consistently needed is somebody who can unify Iraq, right? Or it needs to be broken up, right? And finally, the heir, right? Finally, the error of the British and the French drawing borders that have created conflict throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century. Maybe somebody rectifies that. Maybe a civil war that won't go away rectifies that. So anyway, but it's interesting, right? The Iranian consulate is burned and stoned, right? The patronage system that exists in many parts of the world, this sponsored by Iran, is now being taken. Now, I want to take you to Lebanon. I want to take you to two different reports. The first one is a report from a guy who's just there. Seems to be traveling in Syria, and he's an American. So I want you to just hear what people on the street, when he's interviewing them, say. And I know it's selectively, you know, done, but you can hear that. And then I want you to hear a little bit of an Al Jazeera interview, and then I'm going to share this, a couple of news headlines and this article about SEALs. So here's this guy. What's this guy's name? His name is Drew Binsky, right? Now, I have no idea who Drew Binsky is. Anyway, here he is from Lebanon last week.
If you've seen any global news over the last few months, then you've probably heard about what's happening in Lebanon. Lebanon happens to be one of my favorite countries in the world, and I'm thrilled to be back for a third time. But the streets of Beirut are not how I remembered them. After just spending two epic weeks in Syria, I'm a bit thrown off as I'm seeing this madness across the border.
So this ATM machine is completely spray-painted. It's not working.
What is happening?
It says they've completely spray-painted this ATM, so it showed an ATM with red spray paint across everything, so it's not usable.
Happening right now in Lebanon. Since I'm no expert on Lebanese politics, I decided to hit the streets and interview various locals to get their thoughts.
So in your own words, what's happening right now in Lebanon?
This is a true revolution now in Lebanon, and all the people from different areas, from different political parties, are on the streets and demanding the right to have a proper education system, a proper healthcare, a proper government.
We're having a lot of problems here with the government. Like, everything is just chaos.
The religion is here something amazing, because we have many religions, but now it's a problem for us, because they're using it so we can be against each other.
And how does it feel?
It feels amazing to have hope in our country. I usually don't go to the gym, but I've been walking.
So what you get is a sense of that this is beyond what you've seen, right? Which is Christians against Muslims in Lebanon. That again, that for some reason, this thing against Iranian patronage is somehow rearing its head through the Middle East, which is interesting. Now, this is a report from Al Jazeera. It's called The Inside Story.
And welcome to the program. I'm Nastasia Tay. Now, there had been more than 40 days of largely peaceful protests in Lebanon. But as the political stalemate continues, the country is sliding into turmoil. And in recent days, the demonstrations have turned more violent. On Sunday, supporters of the two main Shia groups attacked protesters in Beirut. And then unrest followed in other parts of Lebanon with various sectarian backgrounds. Sunni leader and caretaker Prime Minister Saad Hariri says he's not going to form the next government. Here's an example of what can happen when rival groups meet in the street.
What happened yesterday is that people from the Amal movement and Hezbollah were protesting. We didn't talk to them or curse them or anything. We were sitting inside the tents and some people stayed here on the street. Suddenly rocks and bottles started to fall on us. The army surrounded and protected us. The Amal and Hezbollah groups threw petrol on us, and the tents caught fire while young people and women were in it. The army relocated us to another tent which they surrounded because all of us were inside of it. One Amal supporter shot in the air to disperse people, and the army also fired a shot in the air, so they left. If the army hadn't done that, they wouldn't have left.
Our correspondent Zena Khoda has more from Beirut.
About a month ago, the Prime Minister resigned. He said he did that. He heeded the call from the street. But the President asked him to stay on in a caretaker capacity. And ever since, the ruling elite, those who are in power, have been negotiating with him on the shape of a new government. He is a popular leader. He is also the Sunni leader in Lebanon. And this is a country which is, there's a deep divide between sects. And if one sect feels that they have been left out of power, then that is dangerous. Despite what we have been seeing in the streets, the multi-sectarian protest movement, at the end of the day, like I mentioned, if someone like Hariri leaves office, then the Sunni community will feel that he has been the scapegoat. Why should he be the only one who doesn't return to office? Why not the Christian leader, the president of the country, Michelle Aoun, or the Shia leader, the House Speaker, Nabi Bury? Why don't they leave office and heed the call from the street? Now, Hariri saying that he's no longer interested. He's blaming, really, his partners in government, saying that you have been blaming me for standing in the way of a solution, that I have been insisting that I am the only one who should return to office. So now I'm stepping out of the way. You can form a government on your own. What Hariri has just done, really, is put the ruling elite, the Hezbollah-led alliance, in a corner. Because if they go ahead and...
The Hezbollah-led alliance, right, is Iran. Everybody, so you can see this this theme of Iran across the from Iran to Iraq. Syria is already its own shit show, and they can't have a protest there because they'll all be killed, and then to Lebanon.
Form a government. It will be considered a one-sided government, which is unlikely to get the support of the international community.
Well, let's take a look at just how we reached this current political crisis. Nationwide protests began in October against high living costs, poor public services, and government corruption. Now, by the end of the month, Prime Minister Saad Hariri had been stepped down. Reforms were proposed, a new Prime Minister considered, but it wasn't enough to appease protesters, and former Finance Minister Mohamed Safari was forced to abandon his bid to lead the government. Meanwhile, normal life has been put on hold across the country. The unrest has disrupted banks, schools, and universities, all of which have at times been forced to close their doors. Well, joining me now are our guests. Firstly, in Beirut, we have Ibrahim.
I just want to listen to a few minutes of this, and then we'll do some more news headlines. But I think I always find that this stuff is incredibly interesting, and so you're going to hear a panel for a few minutes talking about what's going on in Lebanon right now.
Who's a political commentator on Skype in Cambridge, Massachusetts? We have Rami Khoury, who is a professor at the American University of Beirut and is also a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. And also in Beirut, we have Hassan Yunus, who's an author of Trends of Business and is also a professor of International Business Management. A warm welcome to you all. Now, I do want to start with this announcement by Saad Hariri that he doesn't want to form a government. He doesn't want to be the new prime minister. Rami, did this come as a surprise? What is Hariri thinking here?
Nobody knows what Hariri is thinking except Hariri, and whatever he's thinking changes every once in a while because he's a politician in a very volatile country going through a very tumultuous period. A lot of the actions and statements that we're getting from either individuals or political groups, whether it's actions on the ground or media statements, is all political jockeying, essentially, because you've got two big camps in Lebanon now. One of them is trying to radically change the governance system and the national values of Lebanon as manifested in its policies, which is the protesters and their allies. And then you've got the other camp, which is the some of the traditional parties who are not really happy with the protests, and they're trying to maintain the old system more or less as it is with moderate changes. And therefore, any statements that you hear, like Hariri's, are partly designed for political jockeying, and partly they represent serious frustration as well, because the country's falling into a terrible economic collapse if nothing is done soon.
You know, what's interesting is that for, you know, forever in Lebanon, you would have heard this as, you know, Hezbollah, right, the Shiites, and the Christians fighting. Now what you hear is you hear the protesters who come from across the board, and the establishment that includes the Christians and Hezbollah. So it's a different, interesting.
Well, let's take a closer look at that statement from Saad Hariri, the one that he just released. He said, I'm sticking by the rule, not me, but someone else, to form a government that meets the aspirations of young men and women. And then he went on to say, what is more dangerous than the major national crisis and sharp economic crisis our country is passing through, and which is preventing us from dealing with these two intertwined crises, is the state of chronic denial being expressed on several occasions over the past few weeks. Now, Ibrahim, let me ask you, who's he accusing of this chronic denial here?
Well, basically, he's trying, I think Hariri is basically trying to send a message to the other political parties, his previous allies, as we see now, that he's not in good terms and he's not okay with the kind of conditions that they've been trying to put for him to form the government. Mm-hmm. We see that this is all kind of interplay between themselves and for the internal negotiations in between the ruling elite to reach a certain condition whereby they can form a government as per the old ways that they have been using prior to the revolution.
Now, it's interesting. Listen, they're talking about prior to the revolution. So it's the old guard that has shared power in Lebanon for a long time. And the significance of the first report is it is somewhat reflective of the protesters coming from across the board and saying, look, we're sick of the whole thing. We're sick of not having a functional government. We're sick of not having health care, not having an education system, not being able to go to the bank. We're sick of all of this.
This is the way they dealt with each other, and now we can see how this is also manifesting on the streets with what we call rough negotiations, sending out certain kind of sectarian, how they say, thugs, trying to bring back the sectarian and civil war memories to enhance their negotiation conditions in between themselves.
Well, I do want to come to that violence in a second, but before we get there, Hassan, I want to ask you, because Hariri is saying that he's chosen to do this to expedite the formation of a new government. Is this likely to speed things up, or could it just delay things even further?
It would definitely delay things even further because it's an interplay between the traditional parties, as one of the guests has just mentioned, and many accusations to Hariri is that he's awaiting a certain regional password or an international password until the next step becomes clearer. Actually, in Lebanon, we have never been in this volatile, uncertain, complex and ambiguous country decision makers by ourselves. We always await a certain password. We always await a certain deal, which is usually cooked at the regional level, for example, in Saudi Arabia, in Al-Taif, or in Doha, or even internationally, while awaiting the talks between maybe Russia and the U.S., between the P5 plus one countries and other regional or international powers. So I think that this interplay gives Hariri more time to know how the international agenda is being clearer and what would the destiny of Lebanon be. And until then, the things in the streets are escalating and the streets can never be controlled. It's beyond the control of the traditional parties because everything in Lebanon is sectarian. Everything in Lebanon can be politicized.
Well, there are...
All right, so Lebanon... A bit of a boiling cauldron than it's always been, but you're seeing maybe the complexion changing a little bit. So interesting stuff. And I've been meaning to do this for a bit. It's just kind of focus the lens on that and the unrest that you know. Does that mean Hezbollah is losing its grip in Lebanon? Interesting. Or does it mean that just the traditional powers of Lebanon that have historically controlled Lebanon, does it mean that they are losing their grip, which would be an interesting story as well. So, power vacuums, and at least perceived to be in Lebanon and Iraq. And so, interesting stuff. I want to share with you an opinion piece that I saw. Headline, Our Father Helped Found the Future Navy SEALs. His vision didn't include Edward Gallagher. Now, this is written by the son and daughter of one of the guy who was instrumental in standing up the SEALs, their father, Rear Admiral Draper Kaufman. So here's the op-ed piece. Edward Gallagher has brought shame to a community our father helped found. Now he is being emboldened to tear down our nation's premier fighting force by a president who does not understand the consequence of his actions. Our father, Rear Admiral Draper Kaufman, was the founder of the training school for the Navy Underwater Demolition Teams. that became the U.S. Navy SEALs. His heroic bomb disposal actions at Pearl Harbor led to the creation of, and among the first to survive Hell Week, the grueling five-day test of SEAL candidates that continues to challenge the strongest men in our country, and is still described as among the most difficult military training in the world. We can say unequivocally, Dad would have been horrified by the actions of Gallagher and would never have allowed him to remain as part of the Navy SEALs. Gallagher was accused of heinous war crimes by his peers after 2017 deployment to Mosul, Iraq. Soon after these allegations came to light, Gallagher allegedly began to sow discord among his team of brothers, attacking their sense of loyalty while remaining blind to his own misdeeds. His subsequent trial, after which he was acquitted of all but one charge, again left the SEAL community deeply divided. But at least the ordeal was seemingly behind them, until last month when President Donald Trump reversed Gallagher's demotion and ordered that he remain a SEAL, preventing the commander of Naval Special Warfare, Rear Admiral Colin Green, from even starting the formal process of expelling Gallagher from the SEALs. An action that drove an even larger wedge into this politically exhausted group of warriors. Dad deeply believed in the chain of command and in honorable service to one's nation without reward or recognition. We have no doubt that he would have acknowledged Trump's authority to maintain Gallagher as a SEAL. We also would have no doubt that he would have resigned in protest of this debasement of high standards that elite teams like the UDTs and the SEALs must uphold. The Gallagher case is not the first instance in which politicians have undermined these standards, and Trump is not the first president to participate in doing so. A core principle Dad believed was that UDTs and their successors served quietly and without seeking fame or fortune. Indeed, to the best of our knowledge, none of those who served under Dad sought to cash in financially or politically after the war. He certainly did not. Presidents, on the other hand, especially those who have never served in combat, seem to find it irresistible to bathe in the reflected glory of elite military units. They are quick to trade these units and their work for political capital without realizing the effect their Rose Garden ceremonies have on those asked to go in harm's way. The current and former SEALs who deserve our respect are the ones you will never hear about. They don't try to cash in financially or politically during or after their service. They understand that the words of the SEALs ethos, quote, brave men have fought and died building the proud tradition and feared reputation, are bound to uphold. And while they serve, they abide strictly by the military code of conduct, both in deference to those who have gone before and to preserve this vaunted reputation for the next generation. When fellow SEALs violate these rules, those who serve with them are honor-bound to report them. Those in charge are honor-bound to remove them or resign if they are prevented from doing so. As Richard Spencer wrote on being fired as the Secretary of Navy over the Gallagher affair, quote, the rule of law is what sets us apart from our adversaries, close quote. It must remain so, or the vision our fathers started will be lost forever. Spencer and Green are owed an enormous debt of gratitude for taking their stands. Elite units must be allowed to expel rotten apples, and the military must be allowed to independently uphold discipline and the laws of armed conflict. The president is wrong to debase these values. Valor alone is worthless without duty and honor. And then this is about the authors. Draper Kaufman Jr. is a retired academic, author, Army veteran, and Bronze Star recipient from combat in Vietnam. Kelsey Kaufman is an author who now works with her former students from the Indiana Women's Prison. Interesting. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, you've already met him. But, yeah, pretty interesting. Pretty interesting little segment. And, to me, this whole debate, and it's a debate for the soul of the United States Navy SEALs, is that duty and honor have to be, right? They cannot have a Grand Canyon between them. They've got to be together. And what you've seen in relative to what they wrote, the U.S. Navy SEAL community is so far away from that, right? You see them everywhere, right? They're negotiating books and all the rest of it. And so you can see the crisis in the culture. And then Gallagher gets paraded around like he's some kind of embodiment of what American fighting people should be all about. Not that way. All right, we'll take a break. More of All Marine Radio. General David J. Furness, the commanding general of 2nd Marine Division, talking about the biggest exercise that's been done, maybe in Marine Corps history. And out in 29 Palms over the course of the last 2 months, shipped a ton of equipment, a ton. They shipped literally hundreds of tons, thousands of tons of equipment from North Carolina to the Mojave Desert and to be able to exercise. And in the form of a conflict with a peer. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.